Thank you, Ellis. I want to apologize in advance, much of my work, and as well as my mind, has been focused elsewhere of late. I'm a conspiracy theorist by nature, and I can assure you that the best minds in America are thinking of all the worst-case scenarios. Here's one to contemplate. Let's say for some reason it goes to the House of Representatives. By my count and the count of congressional leaders, Republicans now assuredly control 26 delegations. That's only because of Florida, where one race is now in dispute by 125 votes. Let's say the House cannot decide on a president. At that point, it goes to the United States Senate to try to determine a vice president. Let's say, perhaps, the Senate is tied at 50-50. When the United States Senate sits prior to January 20th to make this determination, ties in the Senate are determined by whom? The sitting Vice President of the United States. My topic this morning is George Washington. I would like to discuss him as an exemplar of the old propriety and perhaps develop a Washingtonian understanding of a politics of character, and suggest that this model, rather than being an 18th century historical lesson, is indeed a correct model for our politics today. Washington's politics can be seen in the four great themes of his life: the idea of character itself, his statesmanship, his concern for the Constitution and the rule of law, and his concern for national independence. I'd like to cover those four. That Washington was known for his character is, of course, no accident. His concern for character is seen from the very beginning. We all are familiar with his famous rules of civility and decent behavior in company and conversation, drawn from an early etiquette book written, as it turns out, by Jesuits. Simple rules of conduct form the backbone of character. This is also seen in all of his letters later in life, when he constantly warns his young correspondents the necessity of paying due attention to the moral virtues and avoiding the scenes of vice. To point out the importance of circumspection in your conduct, it may be proper to observe that a good moral character is the first essential to man. It is therefore highly important, he writes, that you should endeavor not only to be learned, but virtuous. Republican government, far from being unconcerned about questions of virtue and character, was understood by George Washington to require self-government. Just as the individual government of the self requires government and rules of good behavior, so popular self-government requires rules and the good habits of citizenship. Character was not a private matter. It was itself a public concern, for the formation of character, whether a man or a nation, was the first and most important step towards independence, prosperity, and happiness. The first transactions of a nation, like those of an individual upon their entrance into life, Washington wrote at the time of the ratification of the Constitution, makes the deepest impression and forms the leading traits of its character. And just as civic responsibility does not flourish in the absence of individual responsibility, so public virtue cannot exist in the climate of private vice. The most important source of virtue, Washington famously advises us, is religion and morality. Religion and morality teach men their moral obligations and create the conditions of decent politics. It is necessary for the maintenance of public justice. A sense of individual religious obligation is needed to support the oaths necessary to the courts of law. But it goes beyond that. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports, he famously writes in the farewell address. In vain would that man claim tribute to patriotism who should subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. No matter what might be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, a nice little dig at Thomas Jefferson, in my opinion, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. The second theme, Washington's statesmanship. Washington's life is a good example of his own advice. His life was a constant striving to control his own passions and habituate the qualities of good character. His moral sense eventually became a second nature. He was appointed to be commander-in-chief because of his character. The vast powers of the presidency, as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention wrote, would not have been made as great had not many of the members cast their eyes towards General Washington and shaped their ideas of the powers to be given to the president by their opinions of his virtue. But there is a link between moral, private morality, and wise public policy, described by the classic virtue of prudence, the practical reasoning by which principles are applied to concrete reality. Prudence is the ability to exercise sound judgment in practical matters, giving to political reasoning its particular character and distinguish it from abstract thought. The catch is that it presupposes, indeed requires, a presence of moral character. As prudence is the preeminent skill needed for political leadership, the measure of the prudent man is first and foremost character. It is no coincidence that Washington was known for his character, but it's also no slight. More solid than brilliant, judgment rather than genius constituted the most prominent feature of his character, John Marshall writes in his famous biography. In this sense, Washington was quite wise. Perhaps the best portrait of Washington was written by Thomas Jefferson, his erstwhile critic. His mind was great and powerful without being of the very first order. His mind was not so accurate, and this is Jefferson's clever, heavy-handed writing here. His mind was not so accurate as that of Newton, Bacon, or Locke. But, Jefferson continues, he was in every sense of the words a wise, a good, and a great man. Why was that? Jefferson concludes, perhaps the strongest feature of his character was prudence, never acting until every circumstance, every consideration was maturely weighed, refraining if he saw a doubt, but when once decided, going through with his purpose, whatever obstacles opposed. His integrity was pure, his justice the most inflexible I have ever known, no motives of interest, of friendship or hatred being able to bias his decision. On the whole, his character was in its mass perfect, in nothing bad, in few points indifferent. The third theme, constitutional government. Washington's politics of character turns on the rule of law. In general, Washington believed that good opinions in the people and good government have a complementary effect on politics. Obeying just government and the rule of law shape people's opinions and morals. On the one hand, he writes, the habits of thinking in a free people inspire caution in their representatives and thereby confine their constitutional responsibilities. On the other, the people learn from the law-making process to curb their own passions. This is, causes them to be moderate and circumspect. Indeed, it is Washington's position in his letters that the Constitution actually encourages moderation and good habits. The separation of powers thwarts governmental despotism and promotes responsibility. Responsible government, in turn, bolsters responsible people. Also, legitimate constitutional amendment process allows reform at the same time that it elevates the document above the popular passions. It is Washington's defense of the dignity and authority of law, however, that is most powerful. Washington tells us that the Constitution is the offspring of our choice, uninfluenced and unawed, adopted under full investigation. And he writes in the farewell address that until it is formally changed by an explicit and authentic act of the whole people, the Constitution remains sacredly obligatory upon all. By its very nature, our government is limited and structured to prevent encroachment, yet energetic to defend our rights. It is our strongest check against tyranny and best guardian of our freedoms. Washington reminds us that it deserves our fidelity and support. This should not cause us to overlook his abiding concern about the corrupting influence of the state, however. He also warns that government tends to encroach on freedom and consolidate power. A just estimate of the love of power, he writes, and proneness to abuse it, which predominates in the human heart, is sufficient to satisfy us of the truth of this proposition. Lord Acton could not have said it better. The fourth theme is independence. In the most quoted and misinterpreted passage of the farewell address, Washington warns against excessive ties with any country. "'Tis our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances," he writes, "with any portion of the foreign world." He recommends as the great rule of conduct that the United States primarily pursue commercial relations. The infamous warning against entangling alliances, by the way, is in Jefferson's inaugural. Washington warns against political connections and permanent alliances. He does not pursue a passive condition of detachment, but an active policy of national independence. He favored harmony and liberal intercourse with all nations. Commerce, not conquest or subservience, will be the primary means of America's relations with the world. But his predominant motive was to gain time for the country to settle and mature its institutions and build the political, economic, and physical strength necessary to give it what he calls the command of its own fortunes. America, he argues, should pursue a long-term course of placing itself in a position to defy external threat and eventually choose peace or war as its interest guided by our justice shall counsel. To be sure, Washington's intent was to establish a strong, independent foreign policy, but it encompasses a sense of moral purpose and well-being, sovereignty in the fullest and most complete sense. For America, this means a free people governing themselves, establishing their own laws, and setting up a government they think will ensure their own safety and happiness. In a word, as Washington told Patrick Henry, "I want an American character." So where does this leave us? The Founding Fathers argued that it takes both the workings of limited government and the proper dispositions and habits of the people to form a good government and good character. If this is correct, the way to restore our national character is to break down the bureaucratic state and rebuild constitutional government on the one hand, and revive the true institutions of civil society on the other. In the end, we must restore what Washington called the indissoluble union between virtue and happiness that exists in the very economy and course of nature. It is necessary, but not sufficient, to say that we need more moral character in our private lives. What we need is for character, in terms of private morality, public character, practical wisdom, and statesmanship, to infuse all aspects of our lives and politics and inform and guide our nation. What are the most important lessons we can take from Washington for today? First, morality does matter. It matters in people and especially our political leaders. In the first inaugural, Washington speaks of the talents, the rectitude, and the patriotism which adorn the characters selected to devise and adopt the law. It is here, and not in the institutional arrangements or measures themselves, that Washington ultimately saw the surest pledges of wise policy. The prevalence of their virtues will ensure that neither local prejudices nor party animosities will misdirect the efforts of the representatives and guarantee that, quote, "the foundation of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Second lesson, statesmanship still counts. Having decisive individuals of good character and judgment is critical. Having one decisive individual is often absolutely necessary. Jefferson reminded James Monroe after the Revolution, "The moderation and virtue of a single character probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been by a subversion of that liberty it was intended to establish. The third lesson: the rule of law is sacred. Ignoring the Constitution, Washington sternly warns, is done at our own peril. Americans must always guard against irregular oppositions to legitimate authority and the spirit of innovation that desires to circumvent the principles of our Constitution. This spirit, he writes in the farewell address, allows, this is almost predictive, it's a wonderful passage, this spirit allows cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men to subvert the people and take power illegitimately by force or fraud. And he goes on to warn that this is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. While the Constitution creates a framework for self-government, it will only work if the people and its leaders uphold the law. As he writes in the draft of his first inaugural, no compact among men, however provident in its construction and sacred in its ratification, can be pronounced everlasting. And if I may express myself, no wall of words, no mound of parchment can be so formed as to stand against the sweeping torrents of boundless ambition on the one hand, aided by the sapping current of corrupted morals. Fourth lesson: how America governed itself in the face of other nations, that is, how America presents itself as a model of republican government, is the most important aspect of our foreign policy. The foreign policy component of the American Revolution is to make the principles and practices of freedom the envy of the world. It will be worthy a free, enlightened, and at no distant period a great nation, Washington writes, to give to mankind the too novel example of a people always guided by exalted justice and benevolence. The elevating theme of America's international purpose is to give moral content to its national interest. Can it be that Providence has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue, he asks? The experiment, at least, is recommended by every sentiment which ennobles human nature. Let me conclude by making an obligatory comment in relation to our current moment. In June of 1783, just a few months after the failure of the conspiracy of Newburgh, in which Washington refused to allow his colonels to overthrow Congress in favor of military rule, Washington issued his last and most famous circular address to the states. America then faced, as we face today, a choice between the legitimate rule of law and the illegitimate rule of men. This is a time of political probation, he wrote. This is the moment when the eyes of the world are turned upon them. This is the moment to establish or ruin the national character forever. We are in a time of political probation, and the world is watching. The time between now and January 20th will test the character of the governor of Texas, and perhaps more so, the vice president. It will also test the character of the presidential electors, who in the end, I might note, are bound by little, save the obligations of justice. But let us be clear, this resolution of this election is not merely about ballots in a particular Florida county, or whether a dead man can be elected to the United States Senate, or whether a judge can extend the hours of the voting booths in St. Louis. It is not even merely about who might be the next president of the United States. It is about the legitimacy of the rule of law, the legitimacy of the Constitution. It is about whether we shall be able to govern ourselves by reflection and choice, rather than be ruled by accident and force. Perhaps I'm in that to say, be ruled by fraud and judicial fiat. In the end, the resolution of this constitutional moment is about our character. Our character is a self-governing people. This is one of those rare historical moments when, depending on how we proceed, we can establish or ruin our character forever. And this, it strikes me, as something we ought to think about on this, the 11th day of the 11th month. Thank you.